My name is Scott Redman. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for inviting me to your party. It's been a great night for me. I had dinner with a bunch of people before the meeting. I'm here with some good friends, and there's some good friends showed up at the meeting. I want to welcome the new people to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're at a great AA meeting. And I just get this out of the way. I'll just put the whole hand up there. I ripped the ligament off the bone taking my socks off. And I'm not good with objects. I'm disoriented, and I've never been good with them. I'm not really good with my surroundings. I've never been okay with my surroundings. And my sons really enjoy it when I deal with any kind of objects. And I actually was making the bed one day. I unfurled a sheet and hooked myself behind the head and drove my head into the bed. But when I start dealing with objects, my sons kind of go, "Watch, watch." Their phone was broken, and I wanted to see if it worked, so I had my phone, and I called my phone with their phone, and my phone rang, and I said, "Who the hell is calling me while I'm trying to fix the phone?" And So if you're new, welcome to AA, and if you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to AA. I'd like to welcome all the tweakers here tonight. Welcome, tweakers. There you go. Dude. I love you guys. You stay real quick for a long time. Every part of your face is moving in a different direction. If you've ever masturbated till you're dehydrated, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're special, special, and we love you. You're so special. I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming close, but I'm really not making fun of you. And I'll tell you why. I don't care what you've got. I don't care if you're like a dope Goliath, the Bigfoot of dope addicts, a crack monster. I don't care. Just catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I caught alcoholism at AA meetings. The infection enters through the ear, and then you start infecting everybody around you. And I couldn't have possibly have been alcoholic for a number of reasons. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. By the time I got here, I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. Boy, that's really unclear. I've used therapy a bunch of times in sobriety to good effect. My colossal mistake is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife once a week and getting these colossal ass poundings. And I had some really strange ideas. I mean, if you the idea of therapy, conventional therapy, if you've been referred to as neurotic, if anybody has ever told you you're neurotic, a neurosis is you have anxiety and you come up with an idea, a way to get out of it, and it's a bad idea. Bad idea. And it actually creates more anxiety. So the idea of therapy is they've got a lot of different therapeutic paradigms. You free associate, you delve into your past, you uncover, discover, it unravels. It works for millions of people. But I have alcoholism. So I go to my therapist. I say, "Look, I feel terrible." "Why?" "Well, I was so drunk yesterday. I was too drunk to walk, so I drove." "Well, let's talk about that. Let me ask you a question. What were you thinking just before you did it?" "Nothing." "I feel terrible. Why?" "Well, yesterday I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a matchbook striker and sucked some heroin up through a fluffed up cigarette filter and shot it. I just feel miserable." "What were you thinking just before you did it?" "Nothing." "Nothing." And I'm telling the truth. Nothing. Nothing. The room spun, my mouth filled with saliva, I went out for a pack of cigarettes and wound up in Baltimore. Nothing. I don't know. And I'm telling the truth. It would take a battery, a panel of therapists working 24/7 just to file my stuff, just to get into a file and put it on a shelf. My alcoholism is so efficient at producing insanity, anxiety, insanity, pathology, problems. I love newcomer plans. I save them. I love them. And I want to share with you my current favorite. A couple of months ago, a friend of mine called me up and he said, well, the bar is raised. I said, what happened? He's working with this guy. The guy's a couple of weeks sober and he notices the guy's got a bruise on his chest. And my friend says, geez, what happened? Guy opens his shirt. He's got these huge purple bruises all over his chest. My buddy said, what? The guy said, look, when I hit my bottom a couple of weeks ago, I was going to kill myself. So I drank a bottle of vodka. I stole a vial of nitroglycerin tablets from a heart patient. And he swallowed the entire vial of nitro and then started slamming his body into the wall, trying to blow himself up. Now, I want to tell you something. If his nickname is not Boom Boom or Nitro, then his home group sucks. You know, if you're new, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism now that you're here. And some of it might make sense to you, and some of it might not. I haven't had a drink since April 22nd, 1985, and to this day, there's stuff, general statements that I hear about alcoholics that I don't identify with. The stuff that I don't identify with, I haven't found in the big book of AA. And yet, I'm not deprecating that stuff. I know it works and makes sense for people. I've heard that alcoholics don't like change of any kind. I don't like change I don't like. But I really like change I like. I really like it a lot. I've never heard anyone get to a podium and say, oh, I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me. I can't, this change is just killing me. But my personal favorite is that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have, just ask Boom Boom, you know. Man. In addition to the therapy, I could not possibly have been alcoholic. I'm Jewish and Jews don't drink because it might dull the pain. And you don't want to squander any agony opportunity. It's funny because one of the first guys that saved my life in AA was this old guy who went to my first home group. And he raised his hand. He said his name. He said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means I don't believe in God. And I'm therefore positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I went and I sat next to him. He really saved my life. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City to a really troubled family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for my wife and I, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it, so the bun was bouncing off her forehead all night. And I had understated the problem. It was Nancy just walked around as if she had been struck by a wrecking ball. It was if you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder who used to get free bales of steel wool. You know, like, here's your paycheck and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the pillows with steel wool. That stuff works its way through on you after a while. So when you were at their house, if you looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit. The whole room was like a living, pulsing, breathing thing. And if you're new, all I've got is good news for you, because my family had absolutely nothing to do with making me an alcoholic. I'm not, and there was a lot of bad stuff. There was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts and mental and physical abuse. And I'm not telling you that I wasn't injured. I was terribly injured, as a kid. And I'm not telling you that I haven't had to do a lot of stuff about that. I have. I am telling you that you can't, they didn't make me a drunk. I can't stop drinking once I start. I just can't. I can't moderate. I can't control. And that would be okay if I didn't have this weird thinking. If I didn't have this bizarre thinking that kept talking me into taking a drink, I can't stop taking. And that would even be okay. I mean, I could probably work that out in therapy or through some medication or something. But the fact is I developed the bizarre fifth wheel, the mystery element, the thing that plucked me beyond any opportunity to be helped by well-meaning clergy, really competent medical professionals, and a family that adored me. It was this soul sickness, this cancer of the soul that I developed. And the landscape of that sickness is resentments, fear, and sexual misconduct. And I didn't even know I had it. I had absolutely no idea. And if you're a drug addict, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous again. You might want to try some controlled crack smoking. Just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood, and blow it out. And we'll make you president. And I grew up in this crazy family and got into trouble real quick running in the Bronx. I was started drinking when I was 12, 13 years old. The 60s hit when I was about 14 or 15, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. So I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? Wow. Wow. Right after WOW usually came, what? What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. I overcame my marijuana problem with pills, and I conquered pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. But that's love. If your last date looks like the opening of a CSI episode, you're welcome. Welcome to AA. And I overcame that cocaine problem with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug, and you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. And I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And I was in my early 20s. I shot some dope. I was hitchhiking on the West Side Highway from the Bronx down to Manhattan. And my aunt and uncle picked me up. My father had had a massive stroke. I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night he died. I couldn't even go into the room and give him a kiss and tell him I loved him and watch him take his light into another room. I was a pig and an animal. I had holes in my arm. The curtain was down. I didn't deserve to be there. I couldn't show up for him or my brother or my mother. And I had to do some really fast work. It was one of those nights where I just simply couldn't fit the pain in my head. And I couldn't be that guy. And it was needles and heroin. And all I had to do was not put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be that guy. So I didn't. Not for 13 years. Shortly after that, I was got a role in a Broadway play, and a new usherette with long brown hair walked in, and I took one look at her. I walked into the dressing room of this cast, and I got up on a chair and told the male members of this company that if anybody talked to the new usherette with long brown hair, that I'd break all the bones in their hands and feet. And we just celebrated 30 years of marriage a couple of months ago, and now, in part, because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time. There's some timing here. There's a lot of timing involved. And And Nancy and I just had a great time. We were in our early 20s, living in New York City. I was acting on Broadway. I had a career that was moving, and she was working at one of the biggest concert halls in New York, and we just had a great time. And, you know, and after a while, she started becoming very troubled from prolonged exposure to me. And I came home one day. We had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers in the house, and I popped the cork on a bottle of wine and emptied the entire bottle of wine into this cup. And I turn around, and my wife was giving me her pre-Al-Anon rat face. And I said, "What?" And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." You know, can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We became so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car? I lent you my car." That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow, you know? You're showing their house, you know. Offer them an hors d'oeuvre. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. Our first son, Micah, was born, and he was really welcomed into the world. We were surrounded by friends and family and got a ton of phone calls. And 2 years and 9 months later, when our son Jesse was born, no one showed up at the hospital. Nobody called. There were no flowers. We had become completely isolated in just 2 years and 9 months. And it wasn't because people didn't love us. It just really hurt too much to be around us. We pressed ourselves on the people that loved us like a thumb upon a bruise. Jesse was sick. He wound up in neonatal intensive care. My wife's all alone in the room, and the doctor called me that night, a doctor I'd never met before, and said, "Your wife's in extreme mental duress, psychological duress. Your baby's sick. Where are you?" And I said, "I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. I can't come down." And this doctor did a pretty remarkable thing. It's a big metropolitan hospital. And she said to me, "My husband's home. I'll give you my phone number and my address, and you can take your son to my house, and my husband will watch him, and you can come to the hospital." And I said, "No." I had no way to accept this woman's generosity. And then my poor son was locked in the house with this insane man racked with guilt and self-loathing. I didn't know I had alcoholism, and I didn't know that my family was starting to suffer from it horribly. I hadn't read our literature. I didn't know about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. I didn't know that the thinking described in the second and third chapter of our book is boilerplated into the people that we love the most. How did it happen again? What's the use anyhow? You know, and in my home, as I've seen in many, many other homes that have decided to stop drinking and take the whooping, the children were locked into either being pointlessly aggressive en route to a goal that never got reached, or just throwing the towel in. You know, why even bother? Why even try? And little were we to know that it was going to continue for 3 more years. This is a horrible thing to say, and I'm going to say it because it was true. From the terrible night my son was born, it was going to be 3 more years from that terrible, humiliating, awful, shameful night. And 3 years later, my sons were 6 and 3. They were having a lot of problems make doing small tasks, small motor stuff. They were cut off from the society of other children. My life had run out between my fingers like a handful of water over and over again. I was unhirable by that time. And my wife was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot from the sickening process that we had gone through. A couple of months before I got sober, Nancy came home and I had had the idea to cook something, but I died in the middle of the idea. She came in the house and I was on the floor with an uncooked pan of eggs in my hand and the stove was on, and she nudged me with her foot and said, "How are you?" And I said, "Exhausted." And she went upstairs and called a doctor and described that there's an empty bottle, an empty vial. She read to him the medicine had been prescribed to me that morning. And the doctor said, he's overdosed. He's dying. Why are you calling me? Call the paramedics. And Nan hung up the phone. And when she tells the story, I get a little nauseous at this point because she says that she hung up and thought, You know, when you call, they come with a fire engine and a clown car and an ice cream truck. You know, everybody's there, you know, and you know, God forbid the neighbors should find out, even though there's a couch, you know, coming out of my window once a week, you know, God forbid. The alcoholic should have a 50-meter couch toss in the Olympics. I think that we would do well at that. She cleaned, did a little cleaning, clean. And then she decided to call another doctor for a second opinion. And she called another doctor, and the doctor said something that I believe saved my life. The doctor said to her, because it was codeine with aspirin, the doctor said, the thing that could really hurt him is the aspirin. And Nancy said, I can deal with an aspirin overdose. I can share that with my family. We're good. And she called the paramedics. Thank God the doctor brought aspirin up. And that was the day she was positive that I couldn't possibly ever drink again. And you know what it was. It was the day my wife ratted on me. I mean, it wasn't my last day of drinking. It was the day my wife couldn't shut up. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed a line I swore I would never cross again. A couple of months before that, this Christian family had moved in next to us, and my sons were hanging out with the kids, and they talked about God quite a bit, and my son Micah came to me and said, Dad, is there anything such as God? And I looked into the eyes of my perfect 6-year-old baby boy, and I said, no. I lied to him. I stood in the face of all this immutable law, all of this poetry, all of this underlying intelligence, and I told a 6-year-old, in essence, you know when you're scared and it's dark and you can't go to sleep? Tough, because that's all there is. He should have been taken from me. I can't imagine a worse piece of information to give a child. And I thought I was saving him some skin so he wouldn't be played like a sap. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. Why? Why not? It was time. See, what would happen to me and happened to me my whole life until 21 years ago is my alcoholism went below the horizon. It stopped presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I would act without sense, without reason, without explanation. Sometimes something wonderful or something horrible would happen, and it would keep it above the horizon as a real piece of business, and I wouldn't drink. But the time and place would come where it would go below the horizon and stop presenting as a real piece of business. And when it's just a complaint, I basically can operate the way I want to operate. And I didn't know that that mechanism was called the strange mental twist that would lead me to a spiritual sickness that there's no end to. Unless somehow I can experience the touch of the master's hand, I can have some sort of deflation and intervention, and something can happen so that my roots can actually start grasping new soil. And on that day, I put a needle in my arm again, and I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist. I told him what I had done, and he said to me, and I didn't know this until I read our literature, he said to me virtually the exact same thing that Carl Jung said to the man who 12-stepped the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. Jung said to this man, and my therapist said to me that morning, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. We can't help you. I cannot help you. And I said, and I love that section in the book where he says, I felt like the gates of hell were clanging shut on me, because that's how it felt. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, the only thing I can suggest is we have you institutionalized. And then he said the one thing that Carl Jung couldn't say. He said, or you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. And why I went to the AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. It's a mystery to me, an absolute mystery. But I woke up at 5 a.m., I got my best clothes on, I got a bad check to write you, and I went to a place called Unit A in the San Fernando Valley for a 7 a.m. meeting. And I walked into that room and took one look around and said to myself, oh my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? Alcoholics Anonymous. How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room looked like it was the product of hundreds of years of inbreeding to me. I mean, it was unbelievable. There were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room, or so it seemed to me. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle. It's a miracle. The furniture, the coffee, they're miracles. It's a miracle. Oh, God. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to break out. I know that's going to happen, right? Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. The AA unsolicited advice guy, he got me at the end of the meeting. You know him. He's usually wearing a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Right. Do I want what you've got? No. No. No, but thanks for spitting on me, Clyde. I really appreciate it. I'll come back next week. We'll hook a rug, okay? I hated it so much and was so appalled. I felt like my DNA was unraveling. I couldn't believe it. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And the only reason and why it's a mystery to me, an absolute mystery. The only reason I can imagine is that I was out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. A friend of mine in the Midwest called me with another great newcomer plan. It's still one of my favorites. Guy was sober for a while, stopped doing the work, got drunk. Got two DUIs in rapid succession. I don't know how he stayed out of the pokey long enough to get two these days, you know? So he came up with a plan. This was his plan. He made 5 Molotov cocktails. He went down to the local county courthouse in order to blow up the courthouse. Thereby, they would lose his paperwork. Does anyone even have paperwork anymore? I don't think there is paperwork anymore. So he put all 4, he put 4 Molotov cocktails on the corners of the courthouse. Now, I've never read the instructions on a Molotov cocktail, but I'm sure that throwing is involved at some point. And then he took the 5th one and laid down in his car and fell asleep. And these days, they get very grouchy when you threaten to blow up a government building. So we don't know where he is. But he doesn't have a court card, I guarantee it. And I was out of plans. And I went to that meeting and met some of the dearest and closest and most important people in my life. I met Milton M. that week, you know, and the guy who 12-stepped me from the gorgeous group of inbreds, you know. And I stayed sober for about 6 months. I was enjoying the gift of step none. But I was going to meetings. My wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups, and I had started bringing my paycheck home, and my sons started not being so scared. And I knew I was going to drink because I had seen the AA drill so many times in just 6 months. I knew I was going to drink if I didn't get to work, and I asked a guy to sponsor me. Great guy. And he made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA, and he invited me to his house and read chapter 5 to me. And on the way through, he took me through the first 2 steps, and we reached step 3 and got on our knees and said a prayer. which I felt was unnecessary and embarrassing, but I did it anyway. And he went back and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step. And it took me 3 months to do my inventory. I went back and read it to him at 9 months. I did step 6 and 7 for the first time, which have really become the centerpiece of my relationship with my higher power. And I wrote up my 8th step list. I try to share this anytime I talk because it's the best reading of step 8 I've ever heard. And I heard it from a guy. I was a couple of weeks sober. His name was Nino. And it was at my other first home group, the men's group at the North Hollywood group, Radford Street in North Hollywood. And his name was Nino. He had a heavy New York accent. He had never read Chapter 5 before. He had a hospital plastic on, and he was reading Chapter 5 for the first time in front of this group. And he got up to Step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what the hell is in here?" It was so gorgeous. It was so pure. And I was glad I wasn't Nino in that moment. But it's the only thing I saw when I saw the list. I didn't see anything else. I went, no, not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back, you know? Not the car. If you're new, it's 8 steps from where you are. Don't worry about it, you know? And it's not, 8's really not even the annoying one. It's 9. It's really the annoying one. So I wrote up my 8-step list, and I didn't really know what I was going to do about it. I didn't know what I was going to do about my wife or my kids or my dad. And I was blessed with a sponsor who wouldn't tell me what to do. He said, "I don't know how you're going to make these amends. Why don't you do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous and see what happens? Why don't you address your inventory as your spiritual task and see what happens?" So I started working. I started getting busy, and I was hanging out with a bunch of great guys who didn't say no. And who were going on panels and sponsoring a lot of people and taking commitments and doing the drill, but they were also very, very tethered to spiritual growth. And we all need different stuff in AA. And for me, I've been asked to tell my story, so what the hell, I'll go ahead and tell it. And there were some old-timers in my area that were saying, you know, "You're an idiot, shut up, sit down. If your lips are moving, you're lying, you're a moron." And I said, "Well, sounds just like home. I don't know why I left the house." with some of these guys, there was this pretense, this assumption that they were very wise because they had all this time. And after I was sober a couple of years, I realized that that really wasn't the case. They were just really pissed off and really mean. And I cut a wide circle around these guys, and I continued to. I'm 21 years sober, and I still do it. There were incredible old-timers like Alabama Crothers and Marie Stenner and remarkable people from my area who talked about doing inventory and working with new people and working steps and didn't have some sense of privilege hooked into time, didn't demand respect. They acted respectful. And that's been the loving hand of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And I know that some people want and need that other kind of treatment. And I got to tell you, I'm kind of making some jokes about it, but I really mean that I don't deprecate it. I don't put it down. I'm just telling you what I needed and what was good for me. I had to start doing stuff that was embarrassing. I had to start going to my kids' school and advocating for them. Teachers were angry at my children. They, you know, they were very intelligent and unable to get work done. And sometimes teachers will get very frustrated and angry at a child who they feel is somehow willfully squandering a gift that maybe another kid would take advantage of. And this one teacher said to me, "You know, I just want to grab him and shake him." And I said, "You know what? He's all shook. We need help. Can you help us?" And no one ever said no. The boys were tested. They got special ed. The teachers said, "Why don't you get them into sports? Get them into music. Let's see if the big motor stuff will impact the small motor stuff." And Jesse wanted to play drums, and I didn't have any dough. But he wanted to play drums. So I went to the music store, and I bought him a drum pad, which is a piece of wood with a piece of rubber on it and 2 sticks and a drum book. And I backed up my kid. And I went back to my home group and I told the guys what I had done. Not to brag, to do it for the same reason if you've got that kind of home group, you would do the same thing. They were really interested in my family. They were really rooting for us. They wanted to know. And within a couple of months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were a lot of burnout drummers in my group at that time. These guys are coming over with these Megadeth drums, and Jesse had a drum set that when he sat behind, he disappeared. You couldn't even see him. He was so small. And about 5-6 years ago, it might even be longer ago now, my sons played the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip in L.A., and they burnt the dump down, playing hip-hop music to a packed room, 800-900 kids, elbow to elbow. And over to the side, there were this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics. You know, the kids are kind of going, what is with the crying old people, man? What the hell is that all about? It's their AA and Al-Anon aunts and uncles that have been following them around for the past 21 years. You told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We stayed the hell away from each other. I had nothing to bring to my marriage. I didn't know how to fight. I would either scream until she shut up, or I would cry until she shut up. I've always loved the tyranny of helplessness. It's always worked very well for me. I also like to loom. I'm a loomer. I like to get a light behind me and get her in a shadow, if possible. It's like total eclipse of the Jew if I get her right in there, right? If I can work a loom, a scream, and a cry into one fight, that's a hat trick. That's the Scott Redmond Couples Workshop right there. That's... I'm bringing nothing. I feel like a kid. I don't feel like a grown man. I've been standing next to guys 10 years younger than me my whole life and saying, I wonder what it's like to be a grown up. Because I don't act like a grown man. I don't clean up after myself. I'm a pig. And I thought in the back of my twisted mind that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. I just saw a woman's expression as if to say, I've heard this before. That's a terrible thing. But there's always some guy when I share that who's thinking marketing, somebody out there. At any rate, I'm bringing nothing, and I had to stay away from my wife until I allowed myself to be sponsored and started sponsoring other people and started learning what it was like to treat another human being with respect and love no matter what. And allowing myself to be sponsored and sponsoring other people and erring on the side of not playing God has done more to develop me as the man that I want to be, the husband I want to be, and the father that I want to be than anything else in my life. When I drew close to him, he revealed himself to me. I was about a year sober, and I want to share this other thing with you. When I was about a year sober, I started sponsoring a guy named Roland, and I sponsor Roland today. I've sponsored him for 20 years. And he used to call my house every night when he was new, and he'd call my house, and he'd leave a message on the machine every night. And he'd say, Scott, it's Roly. I'm sober. I love you. Good night. And when I was sober about 6 years, my son Micah came to me, and he said, you know, Dad, I should tell you this, that when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the machine. And when I heard Roland's voice on the machine, I knew everything was okay and I could go to bed. And this is the kid who I told there was no God to. I try to rip God out of this kid's life, and you came over the answering machine and you tucked him in. I think some nights he just used to stay up till he passed out. But the thing he knew is he knew that Roland wouldn't call if I was drinking. That he knew. And around this same time, when I was about a year sober, I had a ghostwriting job for 20th Century Fox. And this company made an overture to me to be a staff writer on a situation comedy. And I really thought I was becoming a kind of a spiritual Goliath at that time. And I thought if I got this job as a staff director on the sitcom, it would be so great for the guys I sponsor. It would just be wonderful for them because they'd really see the program working. So I directed an episode, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I was just humiliated. I went to my sponsor, and I told him what happened. And he said to me, Well, I guess you have the show business God. I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God keeps me sober. He said, God keeps you sober, and you didn't get a show business job, and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly. And when I came into AA, I heard people talking about God getting them into relationships, God getting them jobs, God getting them parking spaces. Wow, the parking space God. Whew. And if you have a parking space God and he gives you space, pass it on. No. We got nailed in the Northridge earthquake. We were right in the epicenter of it. Our house got wrecked, and I got a bad physical injury, and a guy died right near us and was really bad. And shortly after that, we went up to an AA function out of town, and this woman who used to live in L.A. came up to me and said, oh, I'm so glad that God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, I guess he felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I can't stay sober in that world. I have no interest in staying sober in a world where I've got a God saying, get him, get the Redmond boy. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him, kill his goat, turn his wife to salt, put a finger in his eye, get him. Smote his ass, smote anyone he talks to. We'll figure it out later. Where I've got God like as some deranged game show host. Well, it's boils for you. Let's key your car. You're due for a rash. And there's a reason. You'll figure the reason out. It'll be later on. There's a big, big reason why I just kicked your ass, you know? It's like God is foghorn leghorn. I believe the big book of AA. I believe St. Thomas. I believe the mystics. No one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God. To know God is to not know God. It's an absolute mystery to me. And when I came into AA, I wanted to know, okay, I'm not drinking because of this, because of this, because of this. At the end of the day, there's something deep inside me that is the presence and the great reality. My friend Bob and I love each other. We see each other. We get very excited. There's an incredible connection that gets formed. How crazy is it in this world to think that if you take Bob and I out of the equation, that the connection disappears? It's the face and the breath of God. It is the thing that has kept my alcoholism above the horizon as a real piece of business for 21 years, even when I'm not concentrating on it. Because it's buoyed on the heads and shoulders of 3 million-plus members, the gorgeous women and men of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love you. That mystery used to terrify me, and it doesn't anymore. I hunger for it now, and anytime anyone tries to put it in a box, I walk away from it, you know? I used to hear people say at meetings, I drank because of my feelings, I drank because of this, I drank because of that, and I used to mistakenly say, no, that's not why you drank. Of course it's why they drank. But here's the deal. It's not why I can't stop drinking. I could come up with all the reasons in the world why I drank. Other people drink because of them sometimes. But it's not the reason why I can't drink. I can't stop drinking because I have this bizarre alchemy of this mental problem, this physical allergy, and this persistent cancer of my soul, which if I don't do more in AA at 21 years than when I did at the beginning, and I do because that's who I hang out with, I know what happens. I've seen it over and over again. And so I had to do 6 and 7 that day. I wrote a resentment against myself for almost drinking and a resentment at that company for not giving me that job. And when I did 6 and 7 that day, I said, Pop, please take show business. You got it. I'm giving it to you. I just keep me sober. I'll do anything for a living. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, I did not mean this at all. I didn't. I don't know where. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. This wasn't even like on the long list. I don't know where the hell this came from. And in L.A., they hire a caterer. You know, when you shoot a movie and you make a lot of dough, you're on a set, a movie set, on a vehicle. It's Teamster dough. It's like breaking a racketeering law, for God's sake. And the first movie that I catered, the executive producer and star of the movie, was a guy who I had worked with in the business as a director. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning and he said, "Could I have a burrito, Scott?" And I said, "Well, what's happening, babe?" And he said, "Is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." I got home and I called my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, it's beautiful. And I had to write resentments. I had to write defects of character. I had to work that 10th step. I had to reach out to other men. I had to show up and give them a dime for their nickel. And I cooked and I learned how to be a really good cook. And I wound up being helpful to people, some people who felt that they had fallen from a height when they came to AA. I wound up serving actors I had directed in shows, guys who had worked as my stage managers and assistant directors. I'd come back with a new tale of humiliation to the home group once a week and the guys would just go, ha! I had a friend named Paul who felt he had fallen from a height who I got to help. And he used to say this prayer. He'd say, "Pop, I'm willing to do anything for a living. Just keep me sober. But please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott." And I cooked for about 3 years and I had an overture made to me by this big public relations firm called Ketchum Public Relations for this big comedy writing job. And I thought, you know what? I've suffered so much. If I get this, it'll really be good for my sponsees. And I just, you know, my brain, I went mad, you know. And I had to do a videotape for these guys. And I crashed and burned before I even heard about the job. I went to my sponsor. We had a good laugh. Well, mostly him, but we had a laugh about it. And I released it, and I was cool. And a couple days after that, I found out from Ketchum I didn't get the job, and I was fine. And then I get a call from my catering company to go cater these commercials. And I get on the set, and you get this call sheet, which is all the information about the shoot. And I see that the commercials are for Ketchum Public Relations. So I'm feeding them now. I'm feeding them. And I look down at the end of the truck. There's a guy videotaping me. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. And he's going to go back to New York with it. They're going to watch it. And they're going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? Oh, my God." So I went home. I called my sponsor. And I said, "Oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, it's a miracle. This is just a big miracle. And he said, "You know, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today." And then he said, "You know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do." If you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. If you've stopped drinking, I want to congratulate you. The not drinking part's a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we'd be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. But it's that damn not drinking thing. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. An obsession doesn't. The next time the craving comes up, if you can say a prayer or accept the craving instead of treating it with alcohol. Call one of us. Crawl on your belly. Call central office. Do anything. But if you can take the whooping and accept the craving instead of treating it yourself, you can become available for the removal of this obsession. If you let it break over you like a wave, every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and an obsession doesn't. If you're new, I want to tell you that I love you. I want to tell you that I appreciate all the effort that you're making right now. I also want to tell you that when I was new, it was a terrible thing for me to realize that I had become uncivilized. And the process of becoming plugged in and connected to the face and the breath of God, to this connectivity, has turned me into a gentle man. My sons are or in Cornell and Stanford, but that's not because God likes us more than the people whose children have been annihilated. My God expects me to do my job in AA, if it's to be in an earthquake or not. If it's to show a guy how to stay sober through a 30-year marriage or stay sober through a divorce. My God's not handing out earthquakes, annihilated children. My God, everything is perfect in God's universe and not in man's. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA, and I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. Welcome to AA. Welcome home.